Good morning. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. On July 21st, 2002, expert rock climber Craig DiMartino fell 100 feet after a miscommunication with his climbing partner. Craig landed on his feet, sending a shockwave through his body, crushing vertebrae, shattering his legs, damaging internal organs, and leaving him broken and fighting for life. On today's program, Craig joins us to share his remarkable journey back to health and eventually back to climbing from a fall he had no reasonable chance to survive. Craig will also discuss the mental and physical challenges he faced while trying to rebuild his body and his life, and how he found a renewed sense of purpose and meaning after the fall. Craig joins us today from his home in Colorado, where I hear it is dumping snow. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us today, Craig. It's great to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me here, and thank you for letting me be inside today, because it is really dumping outside my window.
We have spring-like conditions here. It's a lovely 50 and sunny. Okay, well, I guess let's start off with the day of the fall. You and I have talked a little bit, and it's a remarkable event in your life. You said that in the film that you were kind of feeling off or tired that day, and I'm sure you know many in the climbing community and you yourself understand and believe that that fall was one of those avoidable climbing accidents. It's stuff that happens. And so if you can just take us through that day a little bit leading up to it and what happened, what you remember about it, I think that's a good place to start today.
Yeah, for sure. And it was a pretty regular day for me. You know, my friend and I were going climbing up in Rocky Mountain National Park, which is right up the road from where I live. And so, you know, just walking onto the cliff was when I felt a little bit off. You know, you just feel like, I don't know if it's fatigue or just nerves or you're a bit tired from the day before. And we got to the base of the cliff, tied in. We were going to try this one climb called Turn T Buttress. And as I started up it, kind of the butterflies went away. And I actually felt pretty good at that point. And we did three pitches on that route, and it started to rain and snow on us. So we actually retreated that route, went up the hill a little bit, stopped raining, stopped snowing, got really nice. And that's where we picked this climb called White Man, which was an 11C, which is well within, you know, both of our ability ranges. But he had climbed it a couple weeks prior and had some trouble on it, so he wanted me to lead it, which means in climbing parlance that I'm going to go first and put the gear in, and then he wanted to top rope the climb. So we were only going to do the first pitch, which is the first rope length of the climb. So that pitch was 100 feet. And after kind of getting our stuff together, eating a little bit, drinking a little bit, I started up this route, White Man, and it took about, I would say, 20 minutes to lead it, something like that. It's kind of a weird thing to put gear into, so you're putting protection pieces into like the small cracks in the rock, and you know, you have to kind of monkey with it sometimes. It's not real straightforward on that climb, but everything went fine and got to the anchor, and the anchor on that particular climb was three bolts that were driven into the rock from, you know, previous climbers, and I clipped into those directly and yelled down to him that I was off belay, which, if the folks listening aren't climbers, means that I'm safe and connected to the rock directly. I'm not tied to him anymore. And that's, you know, kind of getting the rope ready then, because in my mind, we were going to top rope that pitch. And so because he and I were both very experienced climbers, it never dawned on me to say to him, hey, you know, what do you mean by top rope? I just assumed that he was going to be lowering me to the ground from that anchor. And so I set the rope up for that to happen. So, you know, you run the rope through the anchor, you kind of make sure everything is equalized and running smoothly. And the climb, it's important for me to say to the folks, is that it's an overhanging climb. So I couldn't see my partner. So I could hear my partner, but I couldn't see him. And so once I was off belay, he took me off belay, meaning he took the rope out of his belay device, and he walked about 10 feet kind of over on the other side of the cliff and was getting his climbing shoes out, which he's going to need, because what he was thinking was, Craig is going to bring me up to this ledge 100 feet off the ground, we'll rappel off together, and then we'll kind of do laps on this climb. But again, you know, that wasn't really clarified between the two of us. So once I got the rope running the way I liked it, I yelled back down to him and I said, okay, his name is Steve. I said, okay, Steve, it's all you. And he heard that thinking, okay, Craig's now ready to bring me up to that ledge.
Right.
So he yelled up, okay, man, you're good. And I heard, you know, I was good. So I thought, okay, he's now ready to lower me. And just like as a last thought thing, I just safety conscious thing, I reached over and I kind of tugged on the rope because the rope was kind of coming in from my right. The anchor that I was standing on was a bit to the left of the actual climb. So I reached over to my right and pulled a little bit on that rope, and it felt heavy. But what I learned and thought about later was, you know, the heaviest piece of climbing gear we carry is the rope. And so what I was feeling was about 100 feet of rope hanging down, and that has, you know, a bit of weight to it. And I felt that resistance and thought, oh, you know, Steve has me good. And so I pulled into the anchor, unclipped my self from that anchor and sat back and immediately started falling just right off the back of the ledge. And I had been standing, my back was to the outside of the cliff. So I was facing the cliff and my toes were kind of on this very short kind of, it's probably a 6-inch ledge by about 4 feet long, where my heels were actually hanging off the back of it. So as I sat back, I went off that edge pretty quick and I started to pick up speed. And kind of the first thing I thought was, oh, he has like a loop of slack in the system and it's gonna stop at any moment. And what happened obviously was it didn't stop and I kept picking up speed. And then the second thing I thought was, okay, he maybe has fallen, because I actually had a partner do that. He kind of fell when I sat into an anchor once and he slid a little bit on the ground and I fell a good, you know, 5 feet from the anchor. And that's actually what came right into my head was, oh, he fell down and he's being drugged. Again, not the case. I just kept falling. And then I realized, okay, I'm definitely falling now. So my really only reaction to that was I need to get away from the cliff. I want to see where I'm going. So I pushed kind of with both hands on the cliff and pushed myself out so I could see. And that's a great idea because it gets you away from any, you know, edges, ledges that are sticking out. But it kind of pushed me over sideways. And so from that 100 feet, I was falling basically horizontal to the ground. And if you hit the ground from 100 feet, number one, you shouldn't survive anyway. But right. If you hit it laying down, you're definitely going to die. Everything's just, you know, going to get crushed and smashed. And so I was falling sideways that whole distance to about 20 feet from the ground where there was a tree. It was a dead tree. It was leaning against the cliff and it was right at the base of the climb. And I had walked around it to get on the route. And I hit that tree with my head and it stood me back up to standing, which from that height, you know, a 10-story office building basically is really one of the only ways you can actually survive the fall. And so I hit pretty much in a standing orientation, leaning slightly to the right, and my feet just took the brunt of everything. They basically exploded on impact. My heels, my tibia, and my fibula, I had compound fractures on both legs, that those bones all just kind of came out the insides of my legs. I ruptured the artery in my right leg, so I was bleeding really badly. And that shock wave has to go somewhere. And so as it travels up my body, it got to my lumbar spine and it compressed, it kind of exploded L2. So I actually don't even have that disc anymore. They had to build it back with some bone from my hip. So I burst that disc and my spine kind of sat down on itself and sprayed into my spinal canal. And then it kept going and broke the ribs on my right side, broke my my ribs on my right side, cracked some of my ribs, broke the bursa sacs in my elbows, which are the kind of the lubrication sacs in your elbows, kept going up and broke my neck at C5, C6. And then I just kind of crumpled kind of down onto these big talus blocks, which are the big pieces of rock that have fallen off the cliff. And that's kind of where I came to rest, about 10 feet from my partner. He saw the entire thing happen.
Oh, I can't imagine. I'm watching my producers in there and they're having some facial contortions. It's an incredible event. And I guess the question that comes to mind is, you know, if I've had dreams where I'm falling and you have that moment of like panic, and I cannot imagine what that must be like. How much of that event of the fall is clear in your mind, like one of those sentinel events is burned in? I'm sure you don't remember much after the impact, but what's that like when that, I guess it's panic, it's, or did you just think, how do I survive this?
I think there's a bit of panic, like right when you leave the anchor, you're like, what, you know, that feeling where your stomach loops up, that hits you really hard because you're like, oh God, I'm falling. What's happening? But I think the thing that I remember the most was when I pushed sideways, I could see the side of the cliff and the hillside that we were on. And it was very, very crystal clear to me, like, there's the dirt, there are the trees, there's the blue sky, and there's the ground that I am falling to. And that's kind of the last thing I remember. And it wasn't like a panic, I don't think. It was more just like a realization of I'm falling a long way. And then the next thing I remember was being kind of yelled at by my partner on the ground. I was awake the whole time, but I don't remember, like you said, the impact or any of that. I just remember him screaming in my face and me trying to, like, that first recollection of why am I on the ground, that you really are so confused at that point. And that's kind of like the really burned in piece, where I was looking up at the cliff, seeing his face, and just trying to understand, like, why I was on the ground at that point.
All right. I want to remind listeners, if you're just tuning into the program, my guest today is rock climber Craig DiMartino, who survived a 100-foot fall that really left him broken and very close to death. Craig's talking about his recovery and how he found new meaning and a new purpose for his life after the fall. If you have a question or a comment, I didn't give these phone numbers out, but if you have a question or a comment for Craig, our Anchorage phone number is 550-8433. You can reach us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. If you've never emailed us, you got to spell out line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Okay, in the film, which I watched two or three times, it was the story of you getting to the ambulance and getting taken out of the park and to help. You didn't want him to call your wife, and everybody really thought that it was important that you call your wife because people really didn't think you were going to make it. What was your mindset leaving and going out, and you just didn't want to worry her?
Yeah, I think it was, the first time he asked me, I thought, man, that's a bad idea, just because you don't know how bad you're hurt. You're hurt, right? But you don't know just how extensive it is. And so I thought, man, I don't want to worry her for, not that it wasn't a big reason, but like, I don't want to worry her because I don't really know what's going on. And then when he asked me the second time, it was like, gosh, that's interesting that he asked me twice. I wonder, I must be hurt, worse than I think I am, maybe. So that's when I kind of agreed, and he gave Cindy a call at that point.
And you said to her,
I just said, I didn't say anything. All of a sudden I said, yes, go ahead and call her. And then in my mind, it was like, boom, she was there. It happened so fast in my mind. And I don't know that I got much out. I think she just told me, the kids are good. Everyone is safe. And these guys are going to do, everything they can to get you to the hospital at this point. And then, she has said, afterwards that she just got out of the way. She's like, I just wanted them to do their job, and I didn't want to hinder that in any way.
Right. All right, so you get to the hospital. I mean, it sounds like you really didn't know how bad it was, despite bones sticking out of your legs and incredible. I mean, did you not feel a lot of pain at that point? Your body went through just protecting yourself and the endorphins that come. I mean, were you not that much pain?
No, I was in where I really felt the pain was my back. I never saw my feet. I didn't see my feet probably for a month, because then they were, once they got me to the hospital and after the surgeries and things, they were wrapped up, so I couldn't see them. But my back felt like I had a rock stuck in it, like a big sharp rock right in the middle of my lumbar spine is what I felt. And that hurt like crazy. And when they were putting me into the helicopter, I'm sure that on some level I knew my feet were broken, but when they slid me into the chopper, the bulkhead of the chopper hit both of my feet, and that was actually the first time I felt pain in my feet, because it just like was this splitting, crazy pain, and I had no pain meds at that point because of my lung was punctured on my right side, so I wasn't breathing real well. And so once they got me into the Flight for Life chopper, that air nurse gave me some painkillers finally, and that was right after they hit my feet. So up until that point, it was just a back thing for me, and then all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh, my feet, that hurts so bad. And then he gave me a quick shot, and then I don't remember much about the flight, actually. I don't, he said I was talking the whole time, but I don't, whatever he gave me worked really well, because I don't remember much.
You said the reason you survived, because 100 feet, there's virtually no chance. But the reason you survived was the shock absorption, essentially, that all of your bones breaking and your vertebrae, and that sort of took some of that, it protected your head for one thing.
Right.
And took a lot of the shock out of it. Is that, I mean, how do the doctors explain it beyond that?
Doctors, interestingly enough, didn't really say much about it, but I have some friends who were engineers, and we were chatting about, like, you know, how does the energy absorb? Where does it all go? And they were the ones who kind of explained to me, well, because you hit in a standing orientation, that shockwave actually has some place to go. It has some distance to travel. So even though it breaks all those bones on its way out of your body, you know, when you hit the ground, you don't stop falling. I mean, it takes some time for you to stop, actually, like 2 or 3 seconds. So that absorption has to happen somehow. So if you're laying down, you've shortened that distance that it can travel. So it's much more intense. Whereas if you're standing, the shockwave has somewhere to go. And so, you know, all those bones breaking is a bad thing, but it in the long term, it actually helps you. So that was actually, I think, what saved me. And just, you know, I mean, for lack of a better term, a miracle. You know, just no one should survive that. You know, I talk with people, gosh, all the time, who they fall 10 feet and they're paralyzed, you know, and I fell 100, and, you know, I have a lot of injuries, but I'm, you know, I'm walking around, I'm doing the things that I want to do. And so it's a crazy, weird luck of the draw thing as well.
Sounds like you feel fortunate.
Oh, so incredibly fortunate. You know, even now it's been 15 years and, you know, when you break that many bones, you obviously have to deal with a lot of chronic pain that just joints don't like to have that stuff happen to them. But even on my, I always call it being creaky, even on my creakiest days, you know, I'm still very fortunate to be doing what I'm doing and have the life that I have, you know, after something like that.
All right. We're going to get into, what that life is like and what that recovery was like, right before we go to break, I just want to read an email I got from James. He says he was in a rollover accident on the Seward Highway and later struck a moose on his motorcycle. He's had a broken pelvis, ribs, collapsed lungs, sternum separated, kneecap dislocated, concussions. And these are the major body damages I have encountered in my 73 years. He said he's taking a lot of omega-3s, taking good care of himself, doesn't have a lot of pain, will be running the Alaska Heart Run, and has run Mount Marathon for 3 years. So that's a story of overcoming significant injuries, and that's, I think, what we're talking about today. So we're going to go ahead and take our first break. If you're just tuning into the program, my guest today is rock climber Craig DiMartino, who survived a 100-foot fall that left him broken and fighting for his life. Craig is talking today about his recovery and how he found new meaning and a new purpose for his life after the fall. If you have a question or a comment for Craig, please don't hesitate to call in or email us. Our Anchorage number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll return to our conversation with Craig DiMartino. I'm Prentice Pemberton, and this is Line 1, your health connection.
Mm-hmm. Dare to be the one to make a difference in the life of a child. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Get involved. A caring adult can make a lasting impact on a child's life. Know the signs and help prevent child abuse and neglect. This message sponsored by the Alaska Children's Trust.
Welcome back to Line One, your health connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your co-host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning into the program today, my guest is rock climber Craig DiMartino, who survived a 100-foot fall that left him very broken and fighting for his life. My guest today, well, obviously it's Craig DiMartino. He's sharing about his recovery and how he found new meaning and purpose in his life after the fall. If you have a question or comment for Craig, please don't hesitate to call in or email. Our Anchorage phone number is 550-8433. You can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752 or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. Please remember, this show repeats tonight at 8, so if you're listening on Monday evening, you'll be hearing a tape recording and we won't be able to accept phone calls. All right, Craig, in reading the articles and watching the movie and hearing, you know, different people talk about you, one of the quotes was like your full-time job is just being the most positive guy in the world, I think one person said, and always looking for the good in situations. But like after an incident like this, after a significant trauma and you're laying in the hospital and you're, you know, you're an active guy, you're a physical guy. There must have been some doubts. There must have been some feelings. What's going to happen? How am I going to climb with my kids? How's this going to change my life? What's the recovery going to be like? Was there any point where you kind of lost, you know, your motivation, your hope, or your drive, or just maintain this positive energy all the way through it?
I mean, there's so much up and down when you get this hurt. And a lot of it was, okay, you know, before I got hurt, I was a husband, a dad, a climber. And now all of a sudden that climbing piece is very much in question. And, you know, right after the accident, once I got, I guess, out of like intensive care, I spent about a week there and then into this like orthopedic care. When I got into like the extended care section, that was when I was kind of like, man, I don't even know that I want to climb again because I just got just absolutely wrecked. And so Cindy and I talked a lot about what does that look like, you know? And Cindy early on said, you know, she is a climber as long as I am. She's very much a core climber. And she said to me, if you don't want to climb again, I totally get it. But if you do want to climb again, I totally get that too. And either way, we'll just figure it out. So I had this great kind of open-ended, just what do I want to do and I'll figure it out as I go. But there was, my body, it just didn't work. You know, I couldn't even walk. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't do really anything. And so trying to get your head and be motivated in those circumstances is just so very, very hard. And, you know, every day is just like this constant parade of just huge amounts of pain, taking pain pills, you know, and that's just to like do PT or just like eat breakfast. You're just, right. I mean, you are such a piece of just this chunk of pain that is just recycling every minute. And it's really hard to even stay motivated just to even be up and awake. I mean, just, gosh, that was so hard. But that stuff moves through. I mean, it's a transient process. It's not, I tell people now when they get hurt, you know, it's a very fluid situation. And whatever you're experiencing, you know, myself being this glasses half full guy obviously helps quite a bit, you know, because, you know, I'm all about, well, tomorrow will probably be better or the next minute will be better. And if it's not, then maybe the next one will. But it is always changing. And so once you understand that, oh, okay, this is, you know, whatever I'm feeling right now is not the rest of my life. That's a pretty empowering thing because you realize you have some control there. You get to make that choice of, okay, how do I deal with this now, good or bad? You know, what am I gonna make of it?
So it really was sort of a moment by moment experience for you, getting through the next moment, moving with a positive attitude of mind into into the next step? What is, you know, you went from not being able to feed yourself and or stand at all to small steps. And that's sort of how you took it, is minute by minute, sometimes one day at a time.
Yeah. And literally minute by minute, and just realizing that, okay, there's a lot of people here trying to help me. I had a great support network, not just my wife and kids, but like my family, my friends, the climbing community, everybody kind of got behind me and helped me. And that's a really empowering thing as well. When you know other people are pulling for you and have your best interest at heart, that makes you feel like, okay, I can do this. I don't have to do everything. And, you know, climbers, I think, are very independent minded as a whole. And so now all of a sudden people are helping you, and that's a little bit hard to get your head used to as well. But once you realize, okay, these people want to help me actually get back to my life, then I'm going to let that happen. And so, you know, people came in from all over the country, really, and just stepped up and helped us in so many different ways that kind of helped propel us forward, you know, first minute by minute, and then, you know, day to day, then week to week, then year to year as we progressed out from it.
Yeah, you mentioned climbers are very independent and accepting help, but I would imagine that the climbing community, like any other community of active people, or whether they do that in a isolated environment or not, they rally around around people in their own experience, and that's what you experienced, was really a coming out of your community of people.
Yeah, I think everyone wants to feel like they're a part of something bigger, and these accidents actually allow you to do that in a really tangible way. Because, you know, when somebody gets hurt, they need things. They need basic things. They need food. They need, you know, things picked up, whatever, kids moved around, lawns mowed. You can actually do that really easily. It's a very tangible way to give somebody something small, but that has a huge impact. And so that's one of the brighter sides of these kinds of situations, is you know, as a human being, you get to step up and help another human being and actually see it happen. And that's incredibly powerful as well.
Did receiving those small acts of kindness take on new meaning? I imagine, just, you mentioned somebody mowing your lawn or bringing your groceries for you and your wife, receiving those small acts of kindness, that must have been really powerful from your perspective.
Oh, it's huge in so many ways, you know, because not only do they come, you know, they would come visit us at the house. So that breaks you up your kind of cycle of what you're in. So if you're having like this really rough day, a lot of pain, ups and downs, maybe emotionally, now you're dealing, you have this outside influence that you have to kind of address. And so I think most people put on this nice face when somebody comes to the door, and when you're injured, that's no different. And so, you know, they would come over and spend 10 minutes with me and Cindy, but, you know, you still feel for that 10 minutes like, oh, this is like a regular human interaction, and this is a good thing. Like, it reminds you that these people care about you and they want to just know how you're doing. And that's, you know, that's an amazing thing. It just takes on this really cool, you know, world is small kind of feeling in your heart. And that's a wonderful thing to be a part of.
I think that's an important take-home message for people listening, and because we all know people who experience some sort of traumatic event, some kind of injury or a death of a loved one, and we don't know what to do. What do our words really mean for somebody? And our own discomfort and our own, you know, struggle with reaching out to that person while feeling powerless to help them, we should hear that those little acts really mean a lot to that person.
Yeah, and just do them. Don't, like, you know, don't call up and say, hey, can I do something?
Right.
Because, you know, if it's a person like me and Cindy, they're going to say, no, don't worry about it, we're fine. But if you just, you know, if you roll up there with a bag of groceries, it's going to mean the world to them. If you, like I said, that the person who mowed our lawn, you know, that person just rolled up with a pickup and a lawnmower in the back and mowed the lawn. So it's like, holy crow, that is just really neat to see. And it makes you go, wow, people are actually really good, and that's a fun thing to be a part of.
Yeah, I think that's another important point you make, is you call somebody and say, let us know if there's anything we can do, or
right.
Yeah, we're happy to help if you need anything. Yeah, you're not going to just call people and be like, hey, we need the lawn mowed. Hey, we need, you know, groceries. That's just go do it.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, I have a an interesting email. It's kind of a different perspective, and it's about shock absorption and crush depth. So it goes back to our earlier discussion about how you survived. And it says, when designing car bumpers and front ends of cars, engineers have a term like crush depth, referring to the distance the bumper crushes, allowing the car and the passengers inside it to slow down before hitting the dashboard or other hard surfaces. So crushing the bumpers and crushing the engine compartment absorbs a lot of the energy and slows the passenger cabin. The breaking, she says, or he says, the breaking of Craig's bones and vertebral spaces did pretty much the same thing, protecting his brain inside its compartment. And the brain is like the really the important thing that you needed to protect there, right?
Right, and that's crazy and 100% spot on, because the thing I didn't say when I was describing that was I wasn't wearing a helmet that day, and you know, I hit the ground from 100 feet and have no head trauma, and so, you know, that makes me a crash test dummy for sure. But you know, I should obviously have some head trauma, and I mean, depending on the day, I probably my wife will tell you I do have head trauma, but you know, I don't, and so it's pretty fascinating what the body will do. It amazes me to this day.
Yeah, that is unbelievable. And really the reason, part of it, because head injuries, that your brain, you would have instant death if you had landed on your side. Okay. I guess the other thing I really want to ask you about, because it was sort of a powerful moment in the film, the first time you climbed after the fall. Your wife described it as a turning point for you, but it was an interaction with your daughter that sort of led you to give it a shot. Can you tell us about that day and what that was like?
It was crazy, and the film that we're speaking about is called Craig's Reaction, and it kind of follows this story that we're speaking about, and. We were out. It was probably about a year. It was probably 8 months after the accident, and we were in Lander, Wyoming, climbing at a place we love called Wild Iris. And you know, I was there with Cindy and the kids, and another good friend and his daughter. And we were just, you know, I was just belaying. I wasn't. My leg was still in a cast. My right leg, one of those walking boots, and. Kind of optimistically on the way before we went, I glued a bunch of climbing shoe rubber around it on the bottom of it, just thinking, man, you know,
on the bottom,
maybe
of
I'll
cast.
Give it a go. Yeah. All over the sides, on the bottom, just, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Right.
And, went up there and I was belaying Maya, our daughter. And, she was five at the time. And so she climbs this kind of scrappy little 40-foot route. Gosh, it probably wasn't even that tall, 30-foot tall route. And she, as she's coming down, and I was lowering her, she hits the ground and looks at me and just right away said, are you going to climb that? And it hit me I just wasn't ready for that question. And I didn't really have a quick response. And I thought, I guess I will give that a go. And so untied her, I tied myself in, my friend Jeff, who was with us, put me on belay, and, you know, I started climbing, and it was, hands down, just the most unpleasant, hard, terrifying thing that I think I've ever done, because with every move I made, you know, everything hurt. My hands hurt, my neck hurt, my back hurt, the leg and the cast hurt, and when I finally got up to the anchor, you know, 30 feet later, and it felt like it took, you know, an hour to get there. It probably only took, I don't know, 7 or 10 minutes, but it felt like an eternity to me. When I got there, I was looking at the same type of anchor that I fell from. So this one was 2 bolts in the rock. The one I fell from was 3 bolts, but I had just a complete panic meltdown where I was like, oh God, I'm going to get dropped again. I'm going to fall. I'm going to go this whole distance again. I'm going to get hurt again. And I think when you get hurt really bad, like I did, that the thing you're always thinking of initially when you're back in the same areas is you're going to get hurt again. And it's a terrifying thought because you know what you just went through and you just don't want to do that again. And so looking at this anchor sitting in a harness in a, you know, on the side of a cliff, I immediately just thought, I'm going to get hurt again and probably die this time. And so I couldn't let go. I couldn't sit down in your harness, as which is what you're supposed to do. And I just stood there basically waiting and just couldn't let go, couldn't go up, couldn't go down. And my friend Jeff had me, you know, completely tight, completely locked off, super safe. But that being said, I just couldn't do it. And unbeknownst to me, the cliff kind of rose to my right, slightly up this kind of hill. And Cindy had walked up that hill and she was just watching. And cliffs carry sound really well. So she just all of a sudden started talking to me and she just said, "You're fine. Just go ahead and let go. Jeff has you. You're not, nothing's going to go wrong. Just go ahead and let go." And just hearing her say that, hearing her say it clearly, it felt like she was like right next to me. I just let go. And Jeff lowered me to the ground very, very slowly, probably slower than it took me to climb up. And when I got down, I just remember looking at Cindy and saying, "That's it. I'm never climbing again," because that was horrific. And she was like, "Okay." And I just kind of walked away from it thinking that you know, this just isn't my thing anymore. I just can't do this. And that feeling lasted 20 minutes, something like that. And you start thinking about little things that you liked, which is, I think, what climbers do. And for me, it was just the feeling of the rock again. It wasn't the movement. It was just like, oh, you know, I really like the way rock feels. And that was what stuck with me. And then I just kind of took that back to the campsite. And that was my nightly focus, I think. And then, you know, the next day went back out there and scared myself silly again and swore it off again and just kept doing that over over the next couple of years, I think.
Did that fear, I mean, because what you're talking about is a trauma response and getting back in that same situation, looking at the rope, all those memories just flashing through your mind. I kind of thought you were going to say you got to the bottom and it had just evaporated and you were ready to go, but it was the opposite. You're like, nope, not doing that again. How long did that kind of fear response last for you?
It was on and off for probably no joke, 2 years, where I would, and it wouldn't be every time. I should definitely say that. Like, it wasn't like every time I tied in was this like horrible experience. It was like, it was very hit and miss and I couldn't really even tell you what would make it happen. So some days I would go out and climb and I would be psyched. It would be fine. Other days I would go out and if the wind, you know, sometimes it would be environment driven, sometimes it would be mentally driven. Something would just tweak me. And on those days, I just learned like, okay, I just need to back off this a little bit, come back to it tomorrow, and it'll be totally different. And that's kind of how my mentality is usually anyway, where if it just doesn't feel right to me, it's probably just, I'm just not supposed to do it right now. So I can postpone. But like that fear response would come kind of unannounced. It was just sort of show up at my door and be like, "Hey, going to wreck your whole day for you now." But it was never consistent. And I think that's what actually kept propelling me forward was, you know, the times it happened became fewer and I could recognize that and go, "Oh, okay, this is just my brain sorting this out. So I just have to let that process happen."
Yeah. In the psychological world, we call that a trigger. In the climbing world, you call it a tweak. Your brain tweaked but we call it triggering. Yeah. That traumatic response. All right, this may not be the best question, or you might not be the best person to answer this question, because I read how you did not necessarily follow protocol, but Paul wrote in and said he's in rehab for a dislocated ankle and broken tibia. Would you ask Craig to comment on his rehab and the need to follow protocol and not push it? Do you have
So actually, I have an answer for that, oddly enough. So somebody early on, right? Well, actually, so I kept my leg for 18 months. And then, you know, because I realized it wasn't going to heal, decisions had to be made. Do I want to continue this life as like this kind of broken cast wearing person? And, you know, because I basically followed all the protocols up to there, like, this is what we do to save this part of you. And so, you know, everything kind of went the way they said it would. And so when I decided to amputate my leg, I did that 18 months after the accident. And somebody who had amputated both their legs actually emailed me and said, "There, just so you know, go ahead and write off that the whole next year, because your body has to heal. You have to get used to this new thing that you're going to have. How do you walk? How do you balance? All these things mentally, physically." I read that and went, that's not true. Like, this is probably like 3-4 months maybe. And I went into the hospital, amputated, went home, and I don't know, 2 months later was crutching around an open area and tripped on a cord and wiped out and busted my stump on the ground and set me back, gosh, I don't even know how far. And I remember thinking, that's what they're talking about. Like, I should probably be listening to these people. And so I kind of dialed it back and listened a little bit better than I probably was, where, you know, doctors are very conservative and they have to be. So I would listen to them and then kind of make some, I guess, assessments on my own, like, okay, how do I feel actually? And let that be my guide. But, you know, when they would tell me 6 months, you know, I started listening to it because I realized, you know, I can go ahead and push really hard, but then if I get hurt, I just set myself so far back. It's super frustrating. And so I would actually tell that person to listen very carefully what they're saying, because they're actually saying it for a reason.
All right. If you're just joining us today, my guest is rock climber Craig DeMartino, who survived a 100-foot fall that left his body broken and near death. Craig is talking about his recovery and how he found a new meaning and a new purpose for his life after the fall. If you have a question or a comment for Craig, please don't hesitate to call us in. Call in. You'll have to do it in the next 10 minutes or so if you want to get on the air. Our Anchorage phone number is 550-8433. You can call us toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Or email us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this break, we'll be right back. I'm Prentice Pemberton. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Line One, Your Health Connection is supported by a grant from the Alaska Mental Health Trust and listeners like you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in today, my guest is rock climber Craig DeMartino, who's telling the story of his survival of a 100-foot fall that left his body broken and left him near death. Craig's talking about his recovery and how he found new meaning and a new purpose for his life after the fall. If you have a question or a comment for Craig, please don't hesitate to call us or email us. Anchorage number is 550-8433, and you can call us toll-free at 1-888-353-5752, and our email is line1@alaskapublic.org. Craig, can you tell us real quickly about that decision to a little bit more about the decision to amputate? You said it was quite some time afterwards and they were fighting to save the leg. And but what's it like to choose, I guess, to let go of a significant part of your body that is sort of integral to your passion?
Yeah, and that ended up being the crux for me was, okay, I can keep my leg. We did 11 surgeries on that ankle and foot, and it still wouldn't, I couldn't bend my ankle. I couldn't feel it really, except that it hurt all the time. And so they basically got to a point where they said, you're going to have to wear some form of cast the rest of your life, unfortunately. So, you know, climbing at that point became this really strange, am I going to be able to do this again? And I really thought that I wanted to climb again. So once I kind of got to that point, I started speaking with people who had amputated a leg under their own decision and went back to whatever their sport was. Only one climber was like that I knew or that I talked to. Everybody else was kind of like different sports. But I realized they kind of returned to the sport pretty strong. Like they had to do it differently, but that kind of appealed to me. Like, oh, okay. I had climbed about 14 years at that point, and I thought, okay, I do want to do this again. I don't know what it's going to be like, so I'm not going to be able to do it with the leg I have. So once I got there, then the idea of amputation wasn't that crazy to me. Initially, when I first started thinking about it in the hospital, it was terrifying. I mean, it was just this horrific, life-altering thing that I just couldn't get my head around. And then I kind of warmed up to it and decided, okay, this will be a good thing. This will actually, you know, I'm going to have to go back into this, you know, the pain cave, but then, you know, I will actually be able to get out of it and stay out of it, hopefully. And so once I got there, it seemed like a really good idea. Of course, you know, leading up to it, when I went in and told my doctor, he said, yeah, you know what, it's a good decision. Doctors like to save the limb. They don't right. want to get rid of it. But once I said, I think this is a good idea, he was in full support of it, put it on the calendar right away, which actually freaked me out. So I only had about a month in my mind to prepare. I thought it would be like, oh, we'll get to that some
He's
point.
Like, okay, let's go. And yeah.
Yeah, it was that quick. He was like, okay, stand up. Let's go. We're going to walk out to the desk. And we walked out to the desk and he said, okay, when do I operate? This was November. He said, when do I operate in December for this kind of surgery? And she said, the second. He's like, okay, he's the first one. And I was like, wow, that was fast. Like,
let me think about it for a minute. Yeah.
I thought we were going to talk more. And, but then, you know, leading up to it, it was, terrifying, obviously. And just even driving, you know, you drive there, they give you these like sedatives to supposedly calm you down, which do zero. I mean, you are just a basket case when you walk in, because I don't think anyone thinks like, okay, I'm going to cut off a major limb in my life. I mean, I didn't. I never even thought of it. And when I saw amputees, you know, I think I reacted the way most people do. It's shock. It's a shocking thing to see. You're not used to seeing that. And so all of a sudden, you know, I was laying there thinking, ooh, this isn't such a great idea. And that's right when my surgeon showed up and he was like, you're doing the right thing. Don't worry about it. And I had a IV line in already and he just gave the nod and they start you on the sedation train. And then pretty much everything seems like a great idea at that point. You're just like, let's get it going. And that's it. They wheel you in and you wake up. And people had told me, you know, when you wake up and look down, it's going to be shocking. You're not going to have a leg. And when I woke up, it wasn't shocking because I was, you know, fully expecting it not to be there. The shocking part for me was when I got home, you know, obviously off the charts. I mean, it's crazy how much pain you're in. Once they get that under control and you go home, the first time I saw myself in a mirror was that was very shocking to me just because I had never seen it, you know, and all of a sudden there you are in all your glory, missing your leg. And I've got scars all over my body from the accident. And I think just the weight and the scope of the accident kind of hit me at that time. And that took a little while to get used to. I mean, I would be lying if I didn't say that. So once I got over that hump, it gets a lot better, a lot faster, because, you know, you don't have any more surgery at that point. Now you're just on the rehabilitation train. And that's a good place to be because that's going forward as opposed to just kind of lingering in this accident zone. Now all of a sudden you're going away from the traumatic event pretty fast.
Okay. I got to really quickly, because we got only about 9 minutes left and I want to get into some of the work you're doing, but, in this time of opiate, crisis and addiction, did you have a problem? An emailer wrote in, did you have difficulty monitoring the painkillers and were you really careful with that?
I was very, very careful with the opiates just because, you know, everybody hears about all the stuff going on, and I'm not immune to any of that. So
right.
I was on those kind of as as needed basis, I guess, for that first year or two. And now I take a thing called Tramadol to kind of help keep the edge off of what I have as far as broken things go in my body. And I take that kind of as needed. But I've never done a lot of like the hard opiates like Percocet, all those things, Oxy. I did them initially in the hospital and then after surgery, but then I kind of quickly went off them just knowing – like when you take Oxycontin, you feel great because it really does knock the pain down, but you also realize how bad it is for you and how addictive it is. So I just never really went down those roads. I just kind of used them as a crutch to get me out of the pain that I was in right after the incident and then just moved away from them completely. And I don't use any of them at all. I haven't used them in years now. So I've been very fortunate with that.
All right. So this accident, led you in a different direction in your life or added a piece to the stuff that you were already doing and working with people with disabilities. Can you talk about what that was like, how that came about and what you're doing with that?
Yeah, I came back from a climbing trip in Yosemite and after the accident, I kind of started doing these kind of bigger objectives and ramping my climbing back up to kind of actually way past where it was pre-climb. And so I started doing some stuff in Yosemite where I had some success on El Capitan and then kind of different hard climbs around the country. And it was after one of those trips, a friend of mine just said, hey, I'm going to take some veterans climbing on Saturday. They're missing limbs and, you know, various forms from Afghanistan and Iraq. And I want you to come and teach them about how an amputee should rock climb. And I was like, my first reaction was, I didn't really want to do it. I was like, I don't see the point in doing that really. But he's very persuasive and ended up going down there that weekend and meeting these six guys and just absolutely falling in love with it. I loved their excitement. I loved their newness to climbing. And I just thought, okay, this is what I want to be doing. I feel like, you know, I can take what I've learned from my accident and now show that to other people who are in heavy trauma or after heavy trauma and use climbing as this metaphor and vehicle to help them heal. And so from that grew into these adaptive rock climbing clinics that I do. And I work with a nonprofit in Denver called Adaptive Adventures, and folks can find them at adaptiveadventures.org. And what we do is we help people with physical disabilities get active again. And my piece of that is I take them climbing. So climbing has always been the best kind of thing for me to do as far as rehab goes. You know, it helps me mentally, it helps me physically. I love the community. And what I do is I show people that same thing that I love. And so we start in a climbing gym and just get them used to it. You know, like this is how the rope works. This is the safety stuff. And then I move them outside and take them to cliffs here in Colorado or all around the country. I do these clinics all around the country. I was just in Puerto Rico with Cindy. Cindy does a lot of these with me because she has been climbing as long as I have, so has the kind of same skill set I have. And so we just try to open up their eyes like, hey, I know this thing happened and it's rough, but here's the thing. You can have this incredibly full life now. And this injury will just be something that happened. It's a part of you, but it's not the rest of your life. It's not your whole being. It's just a part of you, and it's a part of you like any other part. So here's something that you can do and really have a lot of fun doing. You're outside. You're with a lot of cool people doing a lot of cool things. And that is incredibly healing, you know, strong healing power in nature and just movement in general. So I just try to open their eyes to that.
One of the ladies who is participating in one of your interviewed in the film, I don't know if she's participating in a clinic with you, but she mentioned that just kind of made her mad when somebody who was able-bodied would lead them or guide them. What makes it different for having somebody with a disability, somebody like yourself who leads that and shows that example?
I think it gives, you know, when I walk into that particular arena, I have that credibility of they're going to look at me And usually they'll know a piece of my story. They may not know everything, but they'll know parts of it, you know, that I got hurt rock climbing and come back to rock climbing and do these things. So it gives me a lot of credibility in their world. And so if I say, hey, we're going to do this, this, and this, they go, okay, he's saying that because he does this. So they know that when they go with me, I mean, I'm only a rock climber. So, you know, I have a pretty small skill set as far as the employment area goes. You know, it's rock climbing or nothing. And so it's kind of, they understand like, hey, this is my whole life. This is what I've built my whole world around. So that coupled with the accident gives me credibility. When you have a person who, and not that someone without a disability can't teach these things, because
right.
a lot of the people I work with do, and they're very, very effective. But for me, it's a bit easier. I can just come rolling in and they're like, oh, yep, this guy knows what I'm talking about. You know, when I say my leg hurts, he knows what I'm talking about. When I say this is not working, he knows what I'm talking about. So I just, you know, I'm able to use my accident in this really positive way. And that gives me just an edge as far as credibility goes with this group.
Can you tell us about the first ever ascent, all disabled ascent of El Capitan, and what that was like? How was it different for you and for them?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was again just like a building process. I had been out there climbing with a friend of mine, Hans Florin, and we did the first amputee in a day ascent. That was his idea, not mine. And he at the end of it said, "Man, you know." You should do more. You know, what are you thinking? And I really wasn't thinking anything. And so went back with a buddy of mine, and we tried initially just to be an unsupported disabled ascent, because that hadn't been done before. And we failed miserably. His leg actually fell off 500 feet up and got stuck in some slings. So
not good.
Obviously not good. And not something that you wanted to keep going forward on. So we ended up bailing, and then met up with Hans again and climbed El Cap with him again. We climbed the nose in a day that year. And he said, you know, you just got to try again. It's just like, that's how life is, you know that. And so went back a year after that, in 2006 with another buddy and the same buddy. And we just said, okay, we're just going to do this and not come down until we actually do it. And so we just went up on this route called Zodiac and stayed up there for 5 days and took our time. We were not trying to go fast by any stretch, just take our time and hang out in the portal edges and just really soak it all up. And it was this amazing, great time. I mean, we were up there with a film crew. We made a film called Gimp Monkeys, which ended up being super popular and kind of touring all over the world. And that was just like, I think it just showed this amount of, we went at it as we're just three climbers having fun. It wasn't like raising awareness. It was just, this just should be something that we do, and why wouldn't we do it? And it kind of shows in that film, and it also just showed when we got to the top. I mean, we were all still friends.
All right, Craig,
I
gotta cut you off, but thank you.
Oh, no worries.
We're out of time, but thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, completely.
All right. Join me next week for a discussion about tuberculosis in Alaska. That's next Wednesday, April 17th at 10. Thanks to Ammon Swenson, who handled the web editing, and Zakia Cummings, our producer. And thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line One. Till next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.